The Sunstone Foundation presents After Sonia, New Directions for Women and the Church, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
My name is Marianne Flandreau. We'll be addressing the topic, After Sonia, New Directions for Women in the Church. We have a panel of four. Our fifth member, Cherry Lovelace, will not be with us. She sustained back injuries and could not be here. John Cilito is archivist and assistant professor of library science at Weber State College. He has received degrees in history and political science from the University of Utah. For several years, he has been engaged in research on the left in early 20th century Utah. His article, Socialist Saints, Mormons in the Socialist Party, 1900 to 1920, co-authored with John McCormick, appeared in the spring 1985 issue of Dialogue. Lori Winder Stromberg has her MA in Humanities from Brigham Young University. She presently lives in Chicago, where she is the managing editor of the Journal of Modern History. She was formerly on the board of Exponent 2 and published with them, and was the associate editor of Sunstone, where she also published. Mary Delamar Schaefer received her undergraduate degree from Brigham Young University and her Master's of Organizational Behavior from the Graduate School of Management at BYU. She is presently working as a Community Relations Coordinator for Ogden City, which includes things like citizen involvement, public relations, and organizational development. In the past, she has worked as a private management consultant, and at one time she even worked for Sunstone. She has a 16-month-old daughter, Kami. Lastly, we'll hear from Maureen Jensen Ward, and she is the mother of six, and she tells me that, yes, it is as many as it sounds like. She received her BA from the University of Utah and her master's from Harvard University. She's an editorial consultant and columnist for This People magazine, has written and produced documentaries for KUED. She writes the spoken word once a month and is a communications consultant for public communications for the church. She's a member of the church's General Women's Meeting Committee and has authored three books. She is presently a co-partner in Omega Media. So we'll hear from them in that order, and at the end we will open it up for questions.
I first met Sonia Johnson in the fall of 1979. At that time, she was married, a tithe-paying Mormon with several church jobs, and a Republican. Indeed, she was much more orthodox than I was, both religiously and politically. A month later, she came to Salt Lake City to participate on a panel, a discussion with a number of other Mormon women at the University of Utah's Women's Conference. It was on that occasion that she uttered the phrase that would later be used against her. The words she used were savage misogyny. Actually, Sonia didn't really use those words, at least not in the way they were reported in the press. And in fact, the phrase itself, she had borrowed from a French feminist thinker. None of us attending that lecture that day were aware we were participating in the making of history. I doubt the word savage misogyny even stuck in our minds. I certainly know it didn't stick in mine. Actually, I thought the most radical thing that happened that fall weekend was that I introduced Sonia Johnson to bagels and cream cheese. Well, a lot has happened since then. The last time I saw Sonia, I was giving her a lift up to her parents' home in Logan after a Salt Lake speaking engagement. She was then the presidential nominee of the Citizens Party, and we spent the time discussing her national presidential campaign and various organizations and personalities on the American left. During the period from 1982 until 1984, I covered Sonia's activities, both nationally and internationally, for Sunstone Review. She went nationally and internationally. I stayed in Salt Lake. So I believe that since I knew her when, as they say, and have followed her career since then, I have some expertise and perhaps some different perceptions than the other panelists have here today. I'm intrigued by the title of our session, After Sonia. When I say the name Sonia, all of you in this room know who we are talking about, have some recollection of the events which brought her to public attention, and probably have some strong feelings, either positive or negative, toward her. Few people, it seems to me, seem to be neutral or ambivalent about Sonia. Now, really, there are very few people that you can do that with. I can think of a few national figures that perhaps you can use one name and have that sort of response. Elvis, Ike, and for us baseball fans, perhaps Reggie. There are some in Mormonism as well. Joseph, Brigham, Eliza, Susan, Emma. I doubt, however, we would have this kind of reaction for Barbara, Beverly, or Boyd. Furthermore, I think the title of this panel suggests two other points for consideration. First, it implies that somehow after Sonia's excommunication, some kind of response or paradigm shift occurred among Mormon women as a group. Second, if, as the title of the panel suggests, there is an after Sonia, then there must have also been a before and a during. I find this in some ways very ironic. Sonia was excommunicated because of her vocal support for the Equal Rights Amendment and because she exposed the covert, official church political involvement that was engaged in to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. Her activities in support of ERA and in opposition to the church's political action consisted primarily of three speeches, including her testimony before a Senate committee, which contained a rather irritated Orrin Hatch. Her biggest tactical error may well have been in one speech where she, in effect, crossed the line and described the involvement of the church, of church leaders and the church and an organization in ERA politics officially. Sonia's fight, along with her colleagues in Mormons for ERA, was a political struggle in the political arena, which ultimately went on to include her own ward and stake membership, who, at the direction of church leaders, were lobbying the Virginia legislature in opposition to ERA. However, she and others did not challenge the theological or organizational factors of the church. She did not make a call for priesthood offices or authority for women. She did not urge that Mormons pray to a mother as well as a father in heaven, though such a concept is clearly part of Mormon theology. I recently completed a first draft of a chapter I'm writing for a book on women in 19th century Utah, sponsored by the Utah Women's History Association. My particular chapter has to do with women and religion, and I found much more discussing and interest in some of these issues among these 19th century women than I ever could find among the Mormons for ERA in Virginia. But what about the question of before and during that I raised a few minutes ago? As far as the before goes, Sonia's early life was fairly standard. She was born and raised in a small town, Utah. She attended the local college, married a school classmate who later converted to Mormonism, and juggled having children, keeping house, and finishing her education while putting her husband's career and education first. The then, I think, is well known. Sonia has told her side of the story, particularly dealing with the excommunication in her book, From Housewife to Heretic, and the events in that story have been chronicled in millions of words on paper and on videotape. As those of you who are familiar with what was going on at that period can remember, her excommunication caused a time of pain and of polarization and of anger, and those emotions were not confined to one side or the other. There were other tangible things that happened directly tied, I believe, to that period of crisis. It's important to remember that Sonia Johnson was excommunicated at the end of 1979. If you will look back and what was happening in the church in terms of protests, in terms of disruptions, in terms of pickets, in terms of the issue of blacks in the church and the priesthood, where a number of people, dissident Mormons, were excommunicated, I think you will find that the excommunication of Sonia Johnson fits well into that period of time. It was a period of great turmoil, and we could contrast that with, say, the last 5 years, when there has not indeed been anywhere near the turmoil that there was at that point in time. Other kinds of tragedies associated. A woman in San Francisco that I'm aware of died of a brain hemorrhage, I believe, and the doctors believe it was partly, at least, caused by the depression that she felt over the excommunication and this whole turmoil that was going on. I think there was a reassessment on the part of many Mormon feminists toward their own feelings, not only toward the ERA, but other issues as well. And as I said, there were pickets at conference and banner toes and TV and radio appearances on shows like Donahue, and official church responses to Sonia. There was even a woman named Beverly Campbell who became the church's official spokesperson. Beverly doesn't cause the same recognition that Sonia does, however. And the sense? Well, in the last 5 years, she's written a book that's published both in hard and paperback editions, as well as being a featured title of a major book club. She's lectured throughout the United States and around the world. She made a bid to become president of the National Organization of Women, during which the politics of that organization and hundreds of women members was radicalized. She was given a Champion of the First Amendment Award by Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine, an award previously given to the likes of Martin Luther King. Sonia told Hefner that while she accepted the award and appreciated the recognition, she didn't want the $3,000 stipend that came with it because she wouldn't accept money raised through the exploitation of her sisters. As she sat down, she turned to Hefner and said, "I bet you'd like to excommunicate me too." Her fast in Illinois was a last-ditch effort to focus public attention on the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. It was a Gandhian effort to raise the consciousness on a political issue with moral overtones. Sonia would describe this experience as a spiritual experience. Despite the efforts of some people, including apparently some Mormon women, who derided the group's efforts by eating in front of them. After the fast was broken, Sonia was able to better recover physically than many of the other women were. Obviously, you can't be a Mormon for 40 years and not learn something. And as I indicated, last year Sonia was a presidential candidate who garnered few votes but accomplished something of great importance by becoming the first minor party presidential candidate to receive federal matching funds. In my opinion, that might well be the most long-lasting contribution that she makes as a political activist. Well, since the election, she's been lecturing and working on another book of feminist essays. She recently attended the International Women's Conference in Nairobi, where she helped organize and run the peace tent. And while there, her name was again placed in nomination for the presidency of NOW by a group of women on the convention floor. Well, that's after Sonia for Sonia. The heartbreak of 1979-80, and it was heartbreak, radicalized Sonia, but to hear her tell it, set her free. Echoes of that heartbeat break hit Mormon women, but I wonder sometimes if they were really reflected in the church and to what degree. Did the events of that time polarize more than they did free? Did they simply reinforce the role of women within the institutional church? In the past 5 years, there have been changes for the church and for Mormon women. Partially, I believe, as a result of the efforts of Sonia Johnson. Women have spoken during sessions of General Conference, but more importantly, there have been other moral issues, abortion, pornography, and others, which could have commanded church opposition in the same way that ERA did. But the church has refrained from that all-out mobilization which occurred in many states against the ERA. Of course, it's much easier to see changes in a public figure like Sonia than it is in the lives of ordinary rank-and-file women or men of the church. The church sought to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. Sonia sought to save it. From the wards mobilized to lobby against it, to the chambers of Judge Callister, who ruled against its extension, the church won and Sonia lost. Her cause was not for Mormon women, however, but for all American women, and I would like to think all American people. Most of her sisters were on the opposite side of this particular issue. Many deplored her tactics, and I think a few even reviled her. Fewer, but still hundreds, loved and admired and identified with her. Some of these women left the church when Sonia did, but most stayed to fight the battle from within. Sonia's later activities caused some erosion in the ranks, but there's still a sizable group of Mormon women who looked to her for whatever reason for leadership. Sonia was not a martyr. She didn't die, nor did she stay quiet. She was not necessarily an example, nor a role model. So why the turning point? Why do we say after Sonia? What was it about her and her cause and her excommunication that allows us to use that particular point as a line of demarcation for discussing Mormon women today? Thank you.
A friend of mine who read these remarks prior to this presentation accused me of priesthood envy. This apparent condition creates a certain paradox in my life, since I'm also a product of the late 60s, which means I'm suspicious of all authority and I have an aversion to hierarchy. In other words, I envy something I also resist. At the core of my thoughts and whatever research I've done the last few weeks in preparation for this presentation have been the following questions. What effect has Sonia Johnson, in other words, her excommunication, the issues she raised, etc., had upon the church, if any? What is the church's position on women's role or roles if the church validates various options for women? Has that position changed in the last 5 years? And if so, how and why? What changes or positions should the church adopt with regard to women that it presently does not espouse? What, if any, are the major theological and cultural barriers to the institutional adoption of such changes or positions? Although I shall try to give some examples and evidence for the points I wish to make, I have in no way attempted to produce a scholarly study. My remarks are decidedly impressionistic, gleaned from those resources most readily available to those of us outside of Utah, namely church magazines and manuals, unofficial church publications such as Sunstone, the Sunstone Review, Dialogue, and Exponent 2, copies of relevant speeches from BYU women's conferences and B.H. Roberts Society meetings, and perhaps most important, the views of women in the Chicago area. My remarks are also somewhat pessimistic, despite what some might interpret as a rather upbeat title for this session, After Sonia, New Directions for Mormon Women in the Church. My feeling, and those of many women in my area, is that though the church may have increased its media savvy in the last 5 years, there have been few, if any, significant steps forward for women in the Mormon Church since the Sonia Johnson fiasco. And the primary reason for this is that LDS women remain institutionally powerless. Sonia Johnson represented a challenge to the male hierarchy of the church and the distinctive roles it prescribed for men and women. Then, not surprisingly, most statements in the church manuals and publications dealt primarily with women's role in the home. In 1976, President Spencer W. Kimball, expanding on Genesis, described the creation and appropriate activities of Adam and Eve in their divinely derived roles. As they completed this magnificent creation, they looked it over and pronounced it good, very good, something that isn't to be improved upon by our modern intellectuals. The male to till the ground, support the family, to give proper leadership, the woman to cooperate, to bear children, and to rear and teach them. It was good, very good. According to the 1979-80 Relief Society Manual, quote, it is especially important for a wife to show loyalty and support to her husband as leader in the family. This patriarchal order is the core of successful life. Quoting Elder Boyd K. Packer, who has been quoted and I'm previous in the symposium, and I'm quoting from the same thing, the manual suggested ways in which a woman could show this support. He, namely the husband, needs to know he is protecting you. He needs to know that he is the leader in the family. He needs to have a circle, a family circle with children. This makes all that he must face out in the world seem worthwhile. He needs to feel dominant. He needs to be the protector. When he feels this, he is a better man. He is a better husband. He is a better employee, a better employer. He is better adjusted and happier in life. He can even be more prosperous. But for the sake of all that is important, above all, he can be a better father and better holder of the priesthood. Young sisters, if you take that role from him, the one he needs, you reduce his manhood. And if you take that, we could paraphrase Shakespeare and say, quote, you take that which enriches you not, but makes him poor indeed. It is clear from these statements that the ideal female role being described, in Linda Wilcox's words, is that of a non-wage-earning wife and mother in a nuclear family where the husband is the provider and the woman's energies are directed toward her family, the church, and perhaps community service. Exchanging or sharing of sex roles or any other blurring of traditional distinctions between the sexes is frowned upon, Wilcox continues. A fear is often expressed that declassification would produce chaos and confusion, in Elder Packer's words, reduce a man's manhood, upsetting the orderly pattern and structure of the family and society. Now, I want to add here that I am in no way denigrating the role of mother and homemaker. I am merely questioning it as the only role for women. I am, however, definitely rejecting the notion of patriarchy as the proper order of things. Although some would claim a conscious malevolence on the part of male church leaders in their efforts to combat Sonia Johnson's criticism and thus preserve their privileged positions, I believe that they honestly thought that the patterns they were prescribing were divinely revealed. And their initial reaction to Sonia Johnson was a hardening of the traditional position without, and I think this is very important, any serious reexamination of that position in the light of the issues Sonia raised. Among the general membership, there were undoubtedly some who seriously reexamined traditional roles as a result of the significant publicity Sonia's excommunication prompted. Most, however, rallied round the church leadership, appalled by Sonia's audacious challenge of authority, and defended those traditional roles espoused by the male church hierarchy. Institutional loyalty and support for male church leaders became the focus of the controversy, and the major issues dealt with the balance between personal revelation and authoritative statements, rather than the ways in which our society might oppress women. It was never a matter of issues so much as a question of loss of the spirit, according to one woman in Chicago. If the issues Sonia raised were generally ignored by church membership, why was she so threatening? The major reason is that she used the media so skillfully, especially sensitive to preserving the church's image because of its proselyting mission, and convinced that Mormon women were fulfilled, or at least should be fulfilled, in their divinely instituted role, the hierarchy perceived Sonia and what she represented as a media problem, and they responded in kind. One example was a tribute to women, The Legacy Remembered and Renewed, held in 1982. According to former Young Women's president Elaine Cannon, the series of lectures, concerts, and art exhibits dedicated to the accomplishments of Mormon women in the arts, education, and the sciences were, quote, a showcase for the scope and influence of LDS women, unquote. We want the women all over the world to know that Mormon women do have intelligence and knowledge, echoed Past Relief Society President Barbara Smith. It was perhaps the biggest media event sponsored by the LDS women's organization since their 19th century foremothers rallied at huge mass meetings in a public show of support for polygamy. At the final meeting, one of the several general firesides for women that now occur annually, our legacy was distilled into the following credo of sorts for Mormon women. Quoting, we are of one heart because we have chosen to follow the way that values the widow's might more than power, integrity more than visibility, charity more than charisma. Although undoubtedly engineered for publicity purposes, aren't such meetings, as well as the fact that women are now occasionally speakers in general conference, some indication that women's issues are beginning to be addressed? Perhaps. But a quick perusal of this year's priesthood manual, the quotes of which are mostly from articles written in the 1970s, indicates no modification whatsoever of formerly prescribed rigid patterns and attitudes. My favorite statement, incidentally, is quoted from a speech by Marvin J. Ashton. Quote, to the husband who says his wife is the poorest money manager in the world, I would say, look in the mirror and meet the world's poorest teacher trainer. Although agreeing that she could see no significant reevaluation of this inflexible position, the spiritual living teacher in our ward cited instances in recent Relief Society manuals that showed a greater sensitivity to the needs of single, divorced, and widowed women, a more humane approach to rape victims, thank goodness, and an increasing awareness of the problems of spouse and child abuse. She particularly noted an article in the July 1985 Ensign on female career preparedness, entitled Happily Prepared Ever After. The article was prompted by a few compelling facts about LDS women. 10% of LDS women who are between the ages of 18 and 30 will be widowed before the age 60. 35% will be divorced before age 60. 3% will never marry. And 45% will be the primary breadwinner in their homes before age 65. Furthermore, the article stated that a church survey released in 1980 showed that 34% of LDS women work outside the home and that 57% did so to meet basic living expenses. Another 35% were working because they were widowed or divorced. 17% said they needed involvement and self-expression outside the home, and 8% said they were career women. Citing statistics that indicate that 9 out of 10 women in the United States will work outside their homes at one time or another in their lives, the article asked, are we prepared? Of course, most of us could find some kind of employment, but we should prepare ourselves for work. I'm quoting again from the article. But we should prepare ourselves for work in which we will not only be happy, but which will also provide an adequate income. The sad truth is that 80% of working women are concentrated in low-wage jobs. Yet the article ends, in our preparations, we need to be prayerful and wise. Surely being with our children is worth more than having a career. No mother should unnecessarily seek a career that takes her out of the home, but we live in a world that demands that we be prepared. I, too, welcome this recognition of reality, but does it represent a significant new direction in our attitudes toward working women? As two career women in my ward put it, will the church ever validate our choice as an acceptable alternative? And in our Relief Society manual for 1979 and 80, 5 years ago, Sister Camilla Kimball said essentially the same thing as the previously quoted Ensign article. I would hope that every girl and woman here has the desire and ambition to qualify in two vocations, that of homemaking and that of preparing to earn a living outside the home, if and when the occasion requires, giving death of a spouse or loss of income as examples of appropriate situations. Clearly, her role as wife, mother, homemaker is still seen as the only appropriate one for LDS women, unless extenuating circumstances demand otherwise. What is apparent is a response and accommodation to pressing social and economic conditions without an accompanying change in philosophy or doctrine. It is evident from the statistics cited that certain changing patterns in the roles of men and women are being thrust upon the church. Indeed, an LDS psychologist who works with a number of LDS couples in the Midwest claims that the tensions created by the double message, evident incidentally in church manuals, of marriage discussed as a true partnership, but juxtaposed with the notion of a presiding authority and a wife in a supportive role, are being resolved to a certain extent by a conscious, and I think that's the word that's important, a conscious redefinition of traditional roles and a disintegration on a grassroots level of rigid patriarchal patterns. And I want to just add here that I think that in most LDS homes, we haven't seen rigid patriarchal patterns in the past. I mean, we've heard a lot of women have given lip service to those rigid patriarchal patterns, but in most instances, when the marriage is happy and functioning, it's been a marriage that reflects really a true partnership and a working together. And that's why I say that now there seems to be a recognition that we're redefining these and a reexamination of these traditional patriarchal patterns. The question then is whether or not the tension created by such changes will prompt a reexamination by church leaders of traditional patterns and doctrines. There is some evidence that it has, however slight. According to an article in Sunstone, church leaders are beginning to recognize, perhaps because of what I understand to be a rising inactivity among young women, that it may be time to get some feedback from its members on changing life experiences. Since it is important for us as church leaders to be aware of the changing life experiences of Latter-day Saint men and women, both in the church and in society at large, the Council of the Twelve has asked the Correlation Department to conduct a national survey in order to hear directly from a cross-section of church members about the impact of these changes on their lives. The 36-page survey, 36 pages, and they I guess they've already got 51% at least back, which is surprising for such a long survey, sent out in 1984, asked for some surprisingly important and candid responses. For example, one section asked the participant to indicate how closely each of the following statements describes his or her experiences as members of the church. Quote, it is unlikely that I can, these are the things they're supposed to respond to, statements they're supposed to respond to. It is unlikely that I can be heard at the church headquarters through the formal channels. I feel that Relief Society lessons and activities are not relevant to my needs and interests. It is insulting to women to have the obey idea remain in the marriage relationship. Another section queries, in general, who do you think has more natural ability to do the following tasks? Men, women, or both are equally capable? And there are numerous ones, and I'll mention the few. Organizing, administering programs, planning, sensing the needs of others, explaining doctrine, caring for children, conducting meetings, making decisions. Participants were also asked to indicate how well they thought the efforts listed below increase women's sense of their own contribution to the church. Recent talks by general authorities which have made efforts to speak to women in all types of circumstances, whether never married, divorced, or employed. The inclusion of women speakers in last April's general conference in each of the sessions. A change in church policy that indicated that opening and closing prayers and sacrament meeting could be offered by men or women. And the fact that bishops have been told they can issue temple recommends to both single men and women who qualify but have not served a mission. Finally, participants were asked to describe in their own words what they, quote, think is the most troublesome problem for women in the church today, unquote. had I been sent a survey, I never sent these surveys. I would have responded to the final question in the following way. The most troublesome problem for women in the church today is their institutional powerlessness. In a church that is led by men and where a majority of decisions are made in the absence of women, or even in the absence of significant information provided by women, Lovina Fielding Anderson told a B.H. Roberts Society audience, I think it is almost inevitable that the role of women will be limited. Sometimes this will be because the capabilities of women are doubted, or because individual women are mistrusted by those in positions of authority. But far more commonly, I believe, they are simply overlooked. This was apparently the case in the recent Chicago Temple dedicatory and cornerstone laying services. June Oakes was asked what appeared to be at the last minute to say a few words, an afterthought in an otherwise unnecessarily male-dominated ceremony. I mean, why couldn't a woman have slapped some of that mortar into the cornerstone? This is a situation, continued Anderson, that has the potential for causing great pain to many individual women and limiting the growth of men and women. Positional power in the church is presently inextricably bound to priesthood. And since only males hold priesthood, females are necessarily excluded from positions of power and authority. Indeed, all major decision-making bodies of the church. But, one might counter, what about the Relief Society primary and presidencies? I learned just yesterday, so I'll include this a little bit to be fair, just recently under Elder Fiennes, female auxiliary leaders were finally included in priesthood committee auxiliary meetings. Previously, they had been represented by the priesthood authority over the women's organizations and primary. And again, formally, only these meetings were only attended by male auxiliary leaders. Do women not then have institutional power? In the words of my ward Relief Society president, women in the church have no power. They are always given their positions by men, and their decisions are always subject to the consent of their priesthood leaders. So similarly remarked Eliza R. Snow decades ago, we will do as we are directed by the priesthood. Furthermore, with the proliferation of church bureaucracy and the coming of the priesthood correlation program, whatever influence women formerly wielded as heads of auxiliary organizations is diminishing. According to this year's priesthood manual, priesthood lesson on priesthood correlation, quote, we expect to see the day when every council of the priesthood in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will understand its duty, will assume its own responsibility, will magnify its calling, and fill its place in the church to the uttermost, according to the intelligence and ability possessed by it. When that day shall come, there will not be so much necessity for the work that is now being done by the auxiliary organizations, because it will be done by the regular quorums of the priesthood. The Lord designed and comprehended it from the beginning, and he has made provision in the church whereby every need may be met and satisfied through the regular organizations of the priesthood. Of course, one way of circumventing this problem without opening up a theological can of worms by giving women the priesthood would be to redefine various leadership and decision-making positions in the church now requiring priesthood, such that they could be filled by non-priesthood holders, namely women. On the other hand, this is a theological symposium where such cans of worms are regularly opened. So, if priesthood is appropriately, and I emphasize that, appropriately tied to positional power, what barriers are there to women being given priesthood authority? First is the obvious and firmly entrenched notion that men and only men appropriately and eternally are eligible to hold the priesthood. Recognizing the potential for dissent inherent in this position, Bruce Hafen, in a speech given at this year's BYU Women's Conference entitled Women, Feminism, and the Blessings of the Priesthood, attempted, I believe unsuccessfully, to make women feel comfortable with this position. Hafen quoted the 10 blessings of the priesthood outlined previously by that great outliner, Bruce R. McConkie. Noting that almost all of them were available to women. They included membership in the church and the fullness of the everlasting gospel, the gift of the Holy Ghost and gifts of the Spirit, sanctification by the Spirit, becoming children of God in the family of the Lord Jesus Christ, the opportunity of eternal marriage and exaltation, and having the power to gain eternal life. Tucked away in his discussion, perhaps to mask its import, was the following line. The one category of blessings in which the role of women is not the same as that of men holding the priesthood is that of administering the gospel and governing all things. A mere trifle. The second major barrier to women holding the priesthood is linked to the first. It is the notion that it is inappropriate, indeed contrary to divine patterns, for a woman to preside over a man, even if a man is not a priesthood holder. And I quote again from a Relief Society manual, where a father is present, he should function as the head of the home with the counsel and support of his wife. This pattern should be followed whether or not the husband is a member of the church and holds the priesthood. It is the revealed role pattern for all married couples. Unquote. Such patriarchal patterns are fundamental to our whole concept of exaltation, with its emphasis on the eternal family unit. And its roots run deep. Benjamin F. Johnson provided a good understanding of the Mormon doctrine of exaltation as he understood it in Kirkland. I'm quoting, "The first command was to multiply, and the prophet taught us that dominion and power in the great future would be commensurate with the number of wives and children that we inherit here, and that our great mission to earth was to organize a nucleus of heaven to take with us, to the increase of which there would be no end." With typical literal-mindedness, early male church leaders asked how a man could become a king without a kingdom. He could not, they decided, and thus women, through polygamous relationships and children, became facilitators of a man's kingdom building, indeed, jewels in his crown. Some have suggested that through the temple ceremony, women are actually made joint holders of priesthood with their husbands and heirs to the same godhood. I have not been comforted in this regard by the ceremonies and instructions in the temple, primarily because whatever eternal powers or promises are conferred upon women are always derivative, subject ultimately to male authority and prescribed patriarchal patterns. The overwhelming response and popularity of Margaret Toscano's paper presented at last year's symposium describing the power Joseph Smith intended for women is very significant, although I believe the paper itself was more a product of wishful thinking than a correct reading of the evidence. Yet such questioning of established thinking, as well as the social norms described before, is raising important issues, issues which must be adequately addressed and resolved by church leaders and its membership. If they are not, a future Sunstone Symposium panel might feature discussion on, after Sonia, divergent directions for women in the church.
I hate for you to see my paper that I have my notes on, because you'll realize it's not as factual as John and Lori. I'm going to tell you my opinion. I never miss an opportunity to do that. About 5 years ago, I was doing some management research, and I got cornered by a manager, who happened to be male, with a question that's happened several times to me in the years since then. The research I was doing was on some training and development, and before I even got into my spiel, he stopped me and he told me a story about how he'd been in a meeting and was totally humiliated by a woman who refused to let him open the door for her. And I thought, oh no, I'm in for a therapy session here. He said to me, "Tell me, what is it that women want?" And I don't recall what I said 5 years ago. I know what I would say now. But since then, I've learned that many times I ask that question, and I don't quite have the capability to answer for all women, but I do like to give my opinion, and that's what I want to do today, is share with you my perspective of what I see happening in my world and with the women that are around me involved in the church, especially in perspective to after Sonia. My analogy for what happened with Sonia Johnson is the story of the emperor's new clothes. Are you familiar with that? Everyone's been in kindergarten in this room. The story is where the emperor was tricked into thinking that he was getting a new set of clothing by some very clever tailors, where actually he was naked. and no one dared to tell the king or the emperor that he was naked, until he was out in the streets, parading down the streets, and some brave kid said, "You don't have any clothes on." That's what I think Sonia Johnson did, is she pointed out to us that we were a little naked. And many of us are still arguing that we weren't naked in the first place, and others of us are arguing that we knew all the time we were naked, and we just didn't get the chance to say it first. But the question of what do you think of Sonia has become one in which I'm afraid I have used, and many women that I know in the church, to discern the many different camps of women that exist in the church. The ones that I have encountered, and those that include many of my friends, are the ones that I'd like to describe for you now. The first group of women are those that never ask the question, "What do you think of Sonia?" And I'm not sure if it's they don't want to know or they're afraid you'll tell them. These are my friends that I call the mainstreamers. They're the women that always take every job that they're assigned to in the church, that always have table decorations for every Relief Society lesson, and I have never seen any of these women bring store-bought cookies to any church function. A long time ago, I gave up on all three of those things, realized that not only did I not want to, but I wasn't even good at competing at those things. Curiously enough, though, these women have been main supporters to me in my life. And while their lifestyles are very different, and they choose very traditional roles as the church might outline them, they always encourage me in what I do, which happens to be totally opposite of their worlds. I've never had a harsh word from a mainstreamer friend. I've never had any kind of discouragement from them. But those are only in one-on-one discussions. They also are not the ones that would stand up next to me when I disagree with a point in a Relief Society lesson, although they might catch me around the corner after the lesson. The next group of women that I categorized are what I call the working but reverent. These are women, and because working outside the home is such a critical issue in the church, they, for economic reasons or because they want to, are working outside the home. They don't dare to speak about it inside the church. I had an interesting experience with a woman at church one day who I would categorize in this group. And she said to me, she was curious about what I was doing at work. I just got a new job, and I was explaining to her. And she said, "Well, I work too. I've been teaching for 10 years. You're probably wondering when I'm going to stop, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, no. What do you teach? What do you do?" And she said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I work part-time during the week, and it provides my family with health insurance, as well as the fact that I love my kids. I think it's terrific." And when I said to her, "I think that's fantastic. What a great deal for a job," she said, "You know, I really love it." And I thought, this is a woman that just said to me, "You're probably wondering when I'm going to quit." And she doesn't want to quit. She said, "In fact, next year my school district has worked out a deal that I can work 2 days a week, be considered full-time, and have 3 days at home with my children." I said, "Hey, that's the kind of job I want." The last group that I would categorize are my very favorite people, many of which are probably here at the St. John Symposium, which I call the saintly subversives. Always ask what you think of Sonia so that they can figure out where their pals are in the ward. After they ask you, they then tell you in a long speech about their whole experience of growing through the church and growing into feminism and how they feel about women. These are my friends that have the guts to stand up in a Relief Society lesson and say they don't agree, or in a Sunday school lesson and say they don't agree. They're the ones that are in cahoots with me on primary lessons where we don't teach that only the dads take the kids to the park or that the moms are always at home doing the dishes. Unfortunately, many of my friends who I call saintly subversive have a hard time staying in the church. And I'm saddened when they leave, mostly for a very selfish reason, and that is because it pushes me further down the line. I like having people on either side of me to help balance what I do. They're totally committed to God. They're totally committed to Jesus Christ. They believe in having family life. They believe in eternal relationships. But many times it's difficult for them to stay without some kind of support system. And if they can't seek it out in the ward that they're in or in the area where they live, then they very easily leave. Like the women's movement in general, I think there's some real correlations to what are happening to women, especially in the after Sonia era, where we've become aware and at least are sensitive to some of the issues and are at least discussing them. The biggest thing to me is that we've gone through a stage, just like the women's movement, where women should do all these things. We should have careers. We should have families. We should, you know, buy the bacon, bring it home and cook it too, all of that. And we can't continue to do that to ourselves. We've had incredible pressures on Mormon women to already be excellent at all the things in the home, and now we have pressures to be excellent at everything we do outside the home as well. If we're gonna go outside the home, then we have to be good at that as well as keeping it together in our home with our children. And my argument is that the next step for Mormon women is to liberate Mormon men and allow them some options in their lives. There's a lot of reasons, I think, for doing that. I see Mormon men caught in many of the role and cultural binds that Mormon women are caught in a very different perspective because of the power situation and because of the kind of authority roles that they hold. But I don't see the freedom for them to do the things that they might want to do with their family or with their children or with their friends. Just like it's often been called cute for women to be career women, I think it's just equally as offensive for men to be thought of as cute for enjoying nurturing their children. And if men aren't allowed options, women are never going to be able to get rid of all these things that we're gathering with us that we feel responsible for. If men aren't allowed options, then we can't share in roles, and we can't trade roles, and we can't enjoy doing what it is that we might want to do. In my current job, I don't have many female friends that are on a peer level because there's only about two women in management in the organization. But I do have several friends that are male that are Mormon. And what I've found that's really been fun is that when we're at work, we talk about management issues, we talk about strategic planning, we talk about teething with our new babies. We talk about their first words. We talk about our whole scope of our worlds, and I really enjoy that. When I go to church with these same men, it's like all of a sudden the relationship that we've developed is severed, and they have a responsibility to follow through on their quote-unquote authority job, and I have a responsibility to go to the primary. Maybe that's appropriate. I find that frustrating, and that's the kind of thing that I would like to see, and hope is happening, a direction that will happen for Mormon women and for Mormon men, is that we learn to share our worlds and really share them in a literal sense so that we can exchange things and help each other. I think I'm liberated and independent and able to think of things in more than one way, that I fall trapped to many of the cultural things that we're all involved in and all are used to. Just recently at a church meeting, I ran into a woman who had a very sick child in intensive care. The child was 2 weeks old. And I stopped and asked her how the baby was, and we spent a lot of time with her rehearsing with me step by step what had happened with the child. A few minutes later, I saw the husband, and I asked him, how is your baby? And then picked up a receipt and walked out the door. As I was walking out, I heard him start to explain to me the same rehearsal that his wife had gone through. And while I would allow his wife to tell me those things, and I would spend time with her, I would not allow myself the same thing with a father. I mean, after all, it's her baby, right? That's the kind of thinking and the kind of direction that I hope is changing in the church, that we look at children as children of two parents, that we look at each other as whole people and not in sections. And that's a difficult thing to do. Like Lori, I see little hope for an institutional change or for a top-down change in our church, but I do see a lot of hope for a bottom-up change, and I see a lot of ways that women who have a big impact on what happens on future generations could really do something about some of these problems. Number one thing to me, which is also something that's important in the women's movement, is we need to look at what kind of language we use and why we choose to use it, so that we begin to think about things in different ways. I teach the star A's in primary, which are five-year-olds, and learn more interesting things about the Mormon Church from them. But they have real different perspective and very refreshing. In the last few months, we've had several lessons on families, two of which, one was on mothering and one was on fathering. I, of course, was eager to examine the differences and where they had set us up. And I have to say that in the mothering lesson, we talked about how mothers wash the dishes and clean the house and make cookies. There was a saving thing in there for mothers. The fathers, though, went to work, and after they went to work, took you to the park and brought you to fun things and activities. In the fathering lesson, they said, please be sensitive to children that don't have fathers in their home. And I was wondering about children who did not have mothers in their home. When I asked my kids what was it that mothers did, they, of course, focused on the cookies. When I asked them what fathers did, they weren't quite sure. Educating our children is a real key to making for new directions in among Mormon women. Not only does it teach children different concepts, but in expressing that and articulating that, I think we change ourselves and our own opinions. Another issue that I think is very important that we look at doing is becoming two-parent families. I started a new job about 8 weeks after I had our child, and the first question everyone asked me was, well, who's taking care of your baby? It takes me aback every time I hear that question, because I think, I didn't do this baby by myself. There are two people involved here, and this child is not my responsibility. I have seen, unfortunately, in many cases of my friends, where they've had a child and the father is not involved with the child at all as an infant. They see the child as their responsibility for getting child care or taking care of or buying clothes or feeding. Not all families are that way, but I've seen enough of it that it's disheartening to me. In our home, we've made a choice at this time in our lives that we have a full-time parent in our home, which is not me. This has pointed out to us over and over as a family that there are such limited options to fathers. Well, everyone seems to think it's a terrific idea to have the father at home full-time. They're not quite sure what to ask about it after that initial reaction, and they feel uncomfortable with the fact that he's home with a child all day. We've had lots of comments like, gee, it'd be nice for me if I could stay home and have nothing to do all day. I said, funny you should say that. I know a lot of women that have heard that before. Lastly, I think it's real important in order to build new directions is to change from tightening our family circles to making them family extensions. We're not a church of neatly defined family units. We're a church of all kinds of relationships and family situations. And the only way that we can really build new directions for Mormon women is to realize that and to work towards including that in what is traditionally known as the Mormon Church. Well, I know it's hard to break historical and cultural bonds, and I still think it's possible. And if it's not possible, at least there are people to commiserate with in the church. Many of my friends who I considered quote-unquote liberated and independent and capable of taking care of their own lives had worked for a number of years and gotten married and then found themselves wishing that they were in the situation that they thought everyone was when they got married, that they would be taken care of financially and emotionally. I'm always surprised at that kind of reaction, and I wondered if their life before marriage was deceptive and they'd done good game at fooling all of us, or that suddenly by getting married they believed in the 1950s generation that each of us would have a home and four kids and a two-car garage. I don't think that's unsimilar, though, to the women's movement in general that women have long thought that we would be taken care of, and somewhere from the very start we have to learn that taking care of is not only something that we all have to do, but something nice to do and does a lot for each of us personally. While this may not have been your experience, the things that I've outlined, I think they're true of many of the women that I know in my age group, of what's happening for them in the Mormon Church, and that there is hope by all of us that at least with sharing ideas that we can begin to develop new options and new directions, if not for ourselves, at least for the children that are coming along behind us.
My focus today is on the bottom up that you referred to, what I see happening in the personal lives of the women that I know. And I do see change. I do see something that I think is exciting happening. A famous anthropologist watched some Australian Aborigines perform an elaborate rite which to an outside observer seemed inconvenient or even painful, and certainly unnecessary. When asked for an explanation of their acts, the Australians replied simply, "We've always done so." They regarded it as somewhat strange for anyone to question why they act as they do. 200 years ago in Europe, we know that it was common for the citizenry to attend the beheadings of those bound for the guillotine. This grisly spectacle was almost a time of celebration, and I'm sure if one of the onlookers had been pulled aside and asked why he was there, he would say, "We've always done so." No matter what culture or what time we live in, much of our behavior, our sense of the way things ought to be and the way people ought to act, is influenced by silent assumptions. By cultural ideas so close to us, they are invisible. We assume all kinds of things without bothering to wonder why we assume them. We've always done so. This idea is crucial to women because until recently, our personalities and lives have seemed to be ruled by a silent assumption. That is that in life we were born to be waiters. In the grand scheme of things, we wait. At dances, we wait to be asked out onto the floor. We wait to be asked on dates. We wait to be asked to be married. We wait to plan our lives and careers until we see how it will fit in with somebody else's plan. Like Cinderella, we wait for the right prince, the right opportunity. We wait for our problems to be solved for us. Traditionally, we have been rewarded for being passive instead of initiators. This is readily evident in, I did some fun research one day looking at, in 1957, all the kinds of articles that were published about women. And this was the quote from an Atlantic Monthly 1957 article, in which the author was wondering why, as he said, Eve is unhappy. In a word, he said, "She's the best dressed, most luxuriously housed, effortlessly propelled, lavishly cosmeticized, painlessly obstetricized, tenderly husbanded, and most protected, respected, supported, and petted woman in the world." Notice anything wrong with that description? Nowhere does this woman do anything besides consume. Other than that, things are done to her. She is not a doer, an initiator of action, a person through whom and by whom a great work can be accomplished. She is instead a sort of sluggishly susceptible jellyfish. One wonders from the vantage of 27 years old, whose permission, 27 years later, whose permission this woman was waiting for to become more fully human. And the same is true today. When we hang back from what we would become, when we are frightened to take that self-revelatory step beyond the comfort zone, we have to ask ourselves again, whose permission are we waiting for? As I look around at my sisters in the gospel today, if I were to make a wish list for us on a personal level, not on an institutional level, it would run something like this. First, I would wish that every woman would really understand that she is a beloved daughter of divine parents, with all of their qualities in embryo, inherited as a natural birthright, every passion, every sensitivity, every skill, every intellectual insight possessed in those parents can and should be developed by the daughter. In fact, if those qualities lie unstirred in cold ashes of the soul, these heavenly parents grieve. Second, I would wish that every woman would have the courage to live beyond stultifying stereotypes that suggest there's only one pattern for the righteous soul. So many of us grieve because we are not the supermom who calmly bakes cookies on Tuesday, a stereotype that's been created in this time and in this place and is not necessarily eternal. I hope it's not eternal. I haven't baked cookies 3 times in all those 6 kids' lives. Third, I would wish that women felt the freedom to make choices and accept the responsibility that comes with that freedom. Fourth, I wish that women would see themselves as initiators of righteousness, as problem solvers with the power to profoundly bless the lives of others and lift the world as they exercise their gifts and ideas. Fifth, I would wish that women saw themselves as each having a divine mission that demanded their personal preparation and spiritual power. And sixth, I would wish that marriage was an equal partnership where each felt the need to support and bless the other and where no one felt a subservient role. But as I make this wish list, I'm surprised. I feel like as I read the scriptures and as I look at the lives of the women around me, that I do not have to wait for permission to start in on any of this. Permission has already been granted. If I do not think so, it may be because I'm afraid to rise up and meet the profound challenge of the gospel. Perhaps it's easier to complain and stand back and think myself fettered than take that first step and call myself free. Whose permission do I need? Are we children of divine parents? Thus saith the Lord, ye are gods and children of the Most High. Do we have to embrace that devastating invisibility that is a stereotype? No. Each of us entered the world not as a finality but a possibility, creating ourselves again every day, learning in faint glimmers here and there something about that intelligence which is uncreated and has been part of us since the beginning. We are as individuals our thumbprints, a wonderful visual reminder that we are never to be content to be mere duplicates of one another or some norm that lies outside of us. No one else can tell us the secret of our identity. It lies inside, in the inward reaches of our own galaxy. Each soul carries with it the yearning for a singular voice, the need to go through the very painful labor and delivery of separating itself from all others. We read in 1 Corinthians, "For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, 'Because I am not the hand, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear shall say, 'Because I am not the eye, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now hath God set the members, every one of them the body, as it hath pleased him." Do we have permission to be free and accept the responsibility accompanying that? "Yes, choose ye this day whom ye will serve," said Joshua. And I was struck teaching the gospel doctrine class this year by a series of scriptures that I had never put together before. The occasion was in 1831 when the elders who had been appointed to return to the East were anxious to ask the Lord by what route and what manner they should return. And the Lord answered, "Let there be a craft made or bought, as seemed you good, it mattereth not unto me." In the next section we read again, "And it mattereth not unto me after a little if it so be that they fulfill their mission, whether they go by water or by land." Or how about in that same section, "Let my servant Sidney Gilbert take that which is needful, as you shall agree." The issue seemed to be to the Lord that the elders made it to their destination. He let them choose the route. More often we think that the gospel gives us a map, so I'm grateful that the gospel gives us a map so we aren't wandering in a trackless desert here. But I think more often than we realize, the details are left to us with the help of personal revelation. I've always been moved, in fact, by the trust that the Lord seems to place in us, the self-reliance he expects. He answers our questions usually only after we've asked them. He demands that we work out our own solutions before he verifies them, rather than spoon-feeding us easy answers. We know that one of the key realities of this existence, if we were to grow, was that we need to be free. And sometimes I wonder if that's too much for us. We try to give our freedom away in big handfuls and instead accept other people's solutions or spend a life that doesn't arise above approval-seeking. Do we have permission to see ourselves as initiators of righteousness, powerfully involved in blessing others and changing the environment, or solving the taxing problems which beset all of us? The Lord has said in the Doctrine and Covenants, "For behold, it's not meet that I should command in all things. For he that is compelled in all things, the same is a slothful and not a wise servant. Wherefore he receiveth no reward. Verily I say, men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause, and do many things of their own free will, and bring to pass much righteousness." Do we have permission to see ourselves as having a divine mission that demands our own spiritual power? Yes. When Moses was shown the world, he fell onto the earth and lamented, "Now for this cause I know that man is nothing, which thing I had never supposed," to which the Lord responded, reminding Moses how far that was from true. "For behold, this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. The worth of souls is great in the eyes of God." Do we have permission to be equal partners in marriage? And like you, Lori, that's what I seem to see as the norm as I look around me. Not subservient, not drowning our identity as we become he. Yes. President Kimball said, "When we speak of marriage as a partnership, let us speak of marriage as a full partnership. We do not want our LDS women to be silent partners or limited partners in that eternal assignment. Please be a contributing and a full partner. So permission has already been granted to proceed on my wish list, the personal wish list. And I suppose the good news is that as I look around me and see more women stepping boldly ahead to fulfill their human and divine possibility than ever before, I see them accepting that permission. The talks I have with other women so often come down to that issue of personal responsibility and moving ahead on the Lord's individual plan for us. Women are beginning, it seems to me, to understand in great numbers what that precious, trusting gift of freedom, responsibility, and growth means. They are beginning to understand what the Lord thinks of their capabilities in handing that to them. Why aren't we further? Why don't we do more? Again, personally, I think it's because taking responsibility for our choices and our identity is really an awesome thing, a process that may take a lifetime to unfold. It's easier to live with fantasies of what we could do, what we would become, what we were meant to be, than take the risk of taking that first step beyond our comfort zone. The first step, after all, demands a lot. It means we quit blaming our parents, our circumstances, our institutions, our situations for what we are or what we become. Reminds me of one day I heard my little girl crying, and I went running in to find that she had run right into the corner of the cabinet, and she'd split her forehead wide open right to the bone. She was sitting in a puddle of blood and crying, but the thing that was so interesting is that she was hitting the cabinet as hard as she could. Well, as far as I knew, the cabinet hadn't moved all day. She had. And I think sometimes we do the equivalent of that in our own lives. We say, because it's easier to find sometimes excuses for why we aren't what we would like to be, why we don't do the things we meant, it's so easy to blame our circumstances. And that's not to say that they don't have profound influence upon us. Obviously they do. We are influenced by stereotypes. We are influenced by those who would not see us as divinely and humanly as we would hope to. But at the same point, we each individually, and this is where it starts, I believe, have to move from seeing ourselves as victims to seeing ourselves as agents. We have to move from thinking that they should do something about my problem to thinking that I should do something about my problem. Now, all of this, of course, involves incredible risk-taking, exposing ourselves to possible failure and exposure of weakness. It involves self-discovery with its attendant realizations of our own weaknesses. We have to ask ourselves those really uncomfortable questions. Who am I? What can I really do? What are my weaknesses? Am I really worthwhile? But it's only when we understand and admit our weaknesses that we move beyond them. It's only when we fail that we can begin to understand how to succeed. Our unfolding is firmly in our hands and the Lord's. Others can help, but nobody else can take over that task. I'm reminded, as a writer when I first started, that I thought, I want to write the great American novel. Who doesn't? But it's a lot easier to live with that fantasy than to sit down to the blank page at the typewriter. And I think that's the way it's with all those things we would do, we want to become, the strengths we want to develop. How hard it is to take that first step, it's easier instead to blame things for the way it didn't work out. Now, there must be some of you who are thinking that this is an optimistic way to view the world. And it is. Don't I know that this is a harsh place where circumstances can overwhelm us, where confidence is sapped because we're not given the validation of our worth from outside, where we move through life and are trapped by missed opportunities, where living happily ever after is a myth because this is a place of trial. Professor Sally Taylor recently gave a talk at BYU with 5 such examples, with names all changed, but they're poignant. Julia had 4 small children, then her husband decided that he didn't want to be married to her anymore. Mary expected to marry but never found the right man. She drifted from one low-paying job to another while she was waiting. Louise's husband was killed in a plane crash, leaving her with 5 children under the age of 8 and no insurance. Patricia found herself severely depressed with the emotional and financial demands of 9 children, some with special health problems, etc. This is not a happily ever after place. When I was lamenting about life's difficulties and the overwhelming difficulty it was for each of us to take responsibility for our lives, to move out in directions that seem appropriate given our free agency, I was talking to a friend whose oldest son had recently left home and, in fact, didn't even speak to his parents for a year. And at the same time, they were thrust into bankruptcy because her husband's business went under. And I thought surely she would lament with me. Yes, this is a world where we are given more than we can bear. And what she answered instead was, the final freedom is the freedom to choose how we respond to these circumstances. And we've heard that a lot, but coming from her, given her circumstances at that time, it was extremely meaningful. Life doesn't have to destroy us. We can still choose how we will respond to the worst conditions. It's the most important freedom we have. And I am reminded of that very personally, because at Christmas time, 3 days before Christmas, we were in the hospital with my husband having congestive heart failure. The diagnosis was cardiomyopathy, Barney Clark's disease. I was a month from having our sixth child and suddenly thrust upon the responsibility of dealing with the fact that my husband may, in fact, have a terminal illness and that I had the financial responsibility for the family. Well, in that kind of a situation, I want you to know that terror becomes great. Vulnerability is overwhelming. But I've learned from that experience and listening to what this friend has said that you can fight down terror, you can step well beyond the comfort zone in stretching yourself, and that remembering with the Lord's help, we can choose how we respond to any circumstance. Shakespeare noted that we should not blame our stars but ourselves, that we are underlings. And Maya Angelou, a black poet who grew up in the most trying circumstances, said rather prosaically, "A tub has to sit on its own bottom." And I keep that in mind a lot. That is not to say that we don't need encouragement from our culture and institutions. Whole groups of people have had their possibilities squelched because they have not been given opportunity and encouragement. And we know that if whole groups of people are considered inferior, that in fact can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I do see the church as an institution giving more and more encouragement for women to realize some of these goals, their own humanity and their divine possibilities. Some recent examples, and some of them are some of the things that Lori alluded to. It went almost without comment that as the church was reorganized into areas with area presidencies, that those presidents' wives, in conjunction with their husbands' calling, were given stewardship over the women in those areas as area general board representatives. Here we again begin to see approaching of what we see as the divine model of a husband and wife sharing a priesthood stewardship, working together in a spiritual calling, each with important responsibilities, rather than the usual role for women of serving mainly as a support. We've seen the general presidencies of the Relief Society, primary and young women, invited to speak in general conference, sit on the stand, invited to meet important dignitaries when they came to town with the first presidency, and be trained by public communications department to be spokespeople for the church. The church has been actively soliciting information through the survey that Lori alluded to about how women feel about their lives and where they need help. It appears that it wants to be reality-based in serving women and not merely prescriptive. And I have appreciated the same thing that Lori mentioned, in that the questions that were asked were extremely honest, and they really did seem to be seeking information. The statement on rape has been changed. The former statement issued in 1974 emphasized the woman's role and the degree of resistance necessary to prevent rape. The new statement focuses on the fact that victims of rape or sexual abuse frequently experience serious trauma and unnecessary feelings of guilt, and should be handled with sensitivity and reassurance. More encouragement has been given for women to get an education and prepare themselves to be happy in careers where they can earn an adequate income. Lori referred to this article in the July issue, and the statistics included, but it's really quite amazing. Though I don't think those statistics would have been included in a church magazine 10 years ago, 5 years ago, the number of women who actually will be responsible for the support of their families. This very week at BYU Education Week, Young Women General President Ardith Kapp urged women and men to seek learning and noted, "Some of our people will marry, some will not. Some will have large families, some will not. But all of us can and should be concerned with the choices we make that can enrich and protect and guard our homes and the homes of others. For some, the choice and commitment may lead to the laboratory and the fight against disease. For another, it could take place in the courtroom defending values and promoting legislation to protect the home and family. For others, in a political circle, articulating values that impact on legislation." Notice what a broad definition she gives to protecting the home. And Professor Sally Taylor gave a talk at BYU recently called "When Mama Brings Home the Bacon," which allowed every mama in that position considerable relief from guilt, saying that women don't work because of sinful self-indulgence, and when they do, it doesn't necessarily follow that the family will dissolve. "You may also see some rewards from this new perspective," she said, addressing the men in the audience. "You may be delighted to see the person you love succeed in a variety of facets, not just as a cook and housekeeper. You may rejoice in her self-actualization, her self-assurance, and her comfortable acceptance of who she is and what her self-worth is." Sixth, we are seeing, I think, what I term a particularly strong young women's presidency, articulating a vision of what young women can do and be as they stand up and speak out. Anyone who's worked at all closely with this group will know that they are achieving some remarkable things, all of which are not visible yet. But, for example, in November, they'll be having a special young women's meeting with a new era that will be supporting that, stating 7 new values for young women, and they are extremely positive, action-oriented, emphasizing accountability, leadership, service, and self-actualization. None of them emphasize this situation, which I think used to be very common, of the young woman as a waiter for life to happen to her. Now, there are those who will look at these things and say they are not enough. They do not begin to help women perceive themselves with all their worth and possibility. And I have, with Lori, felt grief before about the lack of what I see as power for women in the church, that their input is not necessary in decisions. But I think that large institutions take time to change. This is true of IBM or GM or even the church. That's why in the business world, dealing with IBM or GM, there's always room for the entrepreneur with quick response time and flexibility. Stephen Jobs can develop a home computer in his garage much faster than IBM as a giant can. And even though we have revelation to guide us, it still comes often as a facet of asking the right questions and gaining the experience to understand the answer. I believe that the church will be ever increasing in its concern that women perceive their worth and their options. As my friend Cynthia Lynch noted in her paper this morning, it's not enough for the gospel to bestow such possibilities on women or men if they don't perceive it in their regular experience with the institution. But I believe that there is also an effective and an ineffective way to bring about change in the church. I think it happens, and it happens maybe more slowly than some would like to see it happen, but I think it happens when women continue to demonstrate competence, when they find ways to solve problems, when they ask the right questions, when they are patient, and when they embrace the institution and its leaders. It's my experience that the church assumes a defensive posture in the face of attack and confrontation typical of Sonia Johnson's approach. And because I really do love the gospel, I would be eager to work for change in the way that I think would be effective in the church rather than ineffective. Finally, I see it as critical to recognize that permission has already been granted to fulfill even the most demanding rights, responsibilities, and possibilities. And it's always been there. We may do better in helping men and women see that. We individually have a responsibility to provide vision and leadership for each other. As we look around and see the problems that women continue to face, we have to understand that the church doesn't own all those problems either. We have the obligation to work out the solutions of many things for ourselves and for each other, whether it be child care or the feminization of poverty, and I think it's something that we should all be actively involved in. The challenge seems to be, with permission already granted, to move ahead on that painful, halting individual journey to self-discovery and to understanding the implications of freedom and responsibility. The challenge, with permission already granted, is to pierce the reality of the Lord's meaning when he offers the spiritually courageous all things. And to me, that just can't mean that men are always the ones who will govern. The cost for each of us of stopping at yesterday's boundaries, whether they be the Alleghenies or the moon or polio vaccine, can be devastating. With T.S. Eliot, we say, "We shall not cease from our exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
We do have some time remaining in which we'd like to invite you to address questions to any of our panelists. If you'll just stand and speak clearly, right here.
Smart wife. I can only answer, I think, in my own feeling, and that is I don't feel comfortable saying this is what I'm going to do to my bishop, but I do to the primary president. And lots of times I just don't ask. I just do it anyway.
Can you hear the question in the back? Raise your hand if you can't. Will you stand up and address the back so they can hear what... Thank you. Okay. Who would you like to answer the question?
Well, should I get up? Yeah. The question is about the primary organization and the fact that it's always been perceived as a women's organization, and shouldn't men be involved with their children just as fathers, just as women are involved with children as mothers? Therefore, shouldn't they be involved in primary just as much? You see it on the grassroots level. We have a lot in the Hyde Park ward. We were just made a ward. In Chicago, we have a lot of men in the primary working in the primary. But I think, getting back to more philosophically, there is, it's seen as a women's organization in the sense that there are no, men are never called to presidencies, as far as I'm aware, and certainly not on the general level. And it's perceived, again, as you know, you could probably tell from my paper, I was focusing on the institution, and it's as an institution, I think the church perceives the primary as a women's, as women's sphere. Oh, I guess it's a directive from from the church that has gone out that men cannot serve in primary presidencies. It's women's sphere. I'm assuming they just think it's given. What? Oh, yeah, that's right. There is that notion, too. Can I just address that quickly?
No.
That women and men, there's a little, I think because we divide roles so significantly between, you know, that we don't encourage men and women to have friendships because everything is so sexually charged because of this supreme division between men and women. And when you do that, you're afraid of sexual problems developing, and so it would be much better if we didn't have men and women working together, in a sense, and serving together and counseling together in these presidencies and that sort of thing. And so I think we've got to change significantly our attitudes on, you know, how we view that sexually charged atmosphere between men and women before we can start seeing men and women as friends and therefore co-workers.
I have to admit, in my ward, we do have one male primary teacher. We have an ongoing battle, though, that nobody wants to teach primary, male or female. And there's going to be a revolution, especially around the nursery issue, because I think all the women in my ward have said, we've done our duty. I guess in my situation, we have more women that teach primary because they tend to feel a little more guilty. Either that or they want out of Relief Society. I'm not sure.
With that, we will conclude this session, and thank you for coming, and thank our panelists for their excellent papers.